Welcome to the podcast To Be Named Later, where we explore the world a conversation at a time. Sit back and enjoy. Here are your hosts, Chris and Kelly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the podcast To Be Named Later. Chris, my co-host, is off probably celebrating the weekend of college football for the 12-team playoff or something else out in California. I'm back in snowy Wisconsin and talking with a different sort of accessibility guest this time instead of sports. I've got with me someone who I've known the name of for a long time, Judy Dixon, who's an expert on Braille technology and the combination therein. Off the air, just before we started, I told Judy, back when I was in journalism school, one of my first things a professor told me was to be a good journalist, you didn't have to necessarily be an expert on something, you just had to know who was. And that's kind of how I've known the name Judy, talked with her, worked with her on a few projects from time to time. But when I think about Braille and technology, she's always just one of those people that I've come to rely on what she says. So Judy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Happy to be here.
Great. Before we dig into what I asked you to come talk about, which is 3D printing, can we jump back and maybe could you kind of give our listeners, for those that aren't familiar with you, a little bit of the rundown of your career and how you became interested in technology, Braille, and all the rest?
Okay, I can do that. My career, describing it, will be actually pretty short because I started working at the National Library Service for the Blind, and now called Blind and Print Disabled. I started working there in 1981 and just retired in October of this year. So I worked there for 43 years. And over the years, when I started, we were using typewriters and we had no technology, really. I mean, talking book players were record players and we were just using cassette players then. And over the years, the technology evolved and I kind of evolved with it. I was very interested. I got my first VersaBraille in 1981 and CPM computer and then went on to DOS and Windows and all of that and just kind of went with technology. I always loved it and was very interested in it and was able to do a lot of work with technology while I worked at the National Library Service.
You know, you mentioned 1981 and the cassettes. I think it was the orange, wasn't it? Always the training tapes always said the orange C76 cassette player, I think, is one that I had or something like that. I remember using that a lot back in the day to read books.
We got all the way up to C80.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
Of course, before that, it was the big old record player. And I remember the little truly floppy disks before there was floppy disks.
That's true.
8 RPMs, those flexible disks.
Flexible disks, yes.
That was quite a thing. So, you've really been around a lot of the technologies, and I guess close, similar to me, really where we did start on typewriters back in the day. I know I used to have to write all my work in Braille and then type it out.
Yep.
That was never much fun doing my math homework that way, let me tell you. But as I understand it, you know, you're definitely still keeping up with technology. And first of all, congratulations on a great career and your retirement with NLS. It's a service I've used since I was 4 or 5 years old. And it's really always, it's just amazing that it really has gone with the changes. And my understanding, Judy, is of late you've been dabbling in 3D printing.
I have. I got my first 3D printer about a year and a half ago. And it's just been incredible fun. I'm loving it.
So could you kind of level set and give us kind of an overview before we get into some of the hows and the whats and that of what exactly is 3D printing?
Well, there's three different kinds of 3D printers. And there's One's called FDM, Fused Deposit Modeling. And those are the ones that print by having a roll of filament, they call it. It's kind of a roll of plastic string that goes through an extruder and a nozzle and gets melted and then gets deposited layer by layer to build up the model, whatever you're trying to build. We'll get to that in a minute. But another kind is SLA, and that's basically a resin printer. It prints using a liquid, and it's very stinky and very messy. And I have not gotten an SLA printer and probably won't. And then the third kind is SLS, and it has a big vat of powder, and it uses lasers to solidify the powder into an object. And they're very expensive. Most people who buy home printers or hobbyist printers don't use SLS printers. So FDM is, sorry.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
FDM is the easiest, the cheapest, and makes very, very respectable models.
Before we get into the details and further, you hinted at one thing right there when you said the cheapest. Just again to level set, if someone is, myself included, is intrigued by what they learn from you or other sources, and like any technology, I'm sure there's multiple price points, but what would you say is kind of the barrier to entry or the entry fee, if you will, to try all of this, both initial kind of, hey, I got to go find a printer somewhere, and then the filament or kind of ongoing costs, if you had an idea?
The printers range from, you can get a 3D printer for $200. A decent home hobbyist printer would range somewhere between $200 and $1,500. But you can get decent printers in the $500, $600 range. The $200 ones are really tiny, so you're very limited by what you can print. And that's one of the things to consider, what they call in the 3D printer world, build volume. And that's expressed in three numbers, X, Y, and Z. And in 3D printers, almost everything is expressed in millimeters. So you become a metric person when you use 3D printing. And it's my particular printer, the build volume is 235, 235, 250, which is about 9 inches by 9 inches by 10 inches or so. And it's a decent size. It's not tiny. It's not 3 or 4 inches, but it's not huge either. As a matter of fact, my next printer is going to be bigger.
So you got your mind on a new printer already?
I do. I just haven't picked it out yet.
So we'll delve into this a little bit step by step, because I'm sure it's not quite as easy as I'm hoping, but my understanding of the process is you have to either acquire or make a model of something and then get it printed.
Well, there's three steps to the process. You're right. The first one is either get or make a model. And there's plenty of models to get and plenty of models to get for free. There's a great big site called Thingiverse that has about 20 million models available. And then there's a lot of other sites. And there's even specific sites that have models that have been designed for visually impaired people. They'll have braille labeling. And I downloaded a solar system that had braille labels. It was very cool.
Wow, do you remember any of those resources in particular?
I have a long list I could send you sometime.
That'd be great.
There are a couple of good websites that have those kinds of lists. So the second step, though, is slicing. And the slicing step, the models that you download or make yourself, and we'll talk about how a blind person can make their own models. But the second step is slicing. And slicing is getting, when you download a model, it's an STL file. Forget what that stands for, stereo something. And when you, you have to get that model ready for your printer, and you have to tell your printer, you know, how big you want the layers to be, how much infill you want. That's how solid do you want it to be? Because it's gonna, you can use a lot of filament if you make it 100% infill and fill it completely solid, and it'll be heavy. So you can specify how much infill. So for large, I just printed a model of the Provo Marriott, and it's big. It's about 10 inches by 10 inches. But I printed it with 10% infill so that it didn't use, you know, whole rolls of filament. And so it's kind of a honeycomb inside. So you this slicing software, and most printers come with slicing software, and the slicing software that came with mine is completely 100% inaccessible. But there is an accessible slicing software called Simplify 3D that works with dozens of popular printers. And it's really quite, I mean, is it perfect? No, but it's very, very usable. It's really great. And you can, so you have to slice it. So the file that you get to send to your printer is a G-code file. It's actually a text-based file. You can look at it and you bring it up in Notepad, read it. But it tells the printer everything it needs to know about how to print that file. And then the third part of it is printing, which isn't as easy as it may seem, because in my case, again, the printing, because the software is so inaccessible and I can't print from Simplify 3D, what I do, my printer has a port for a USB-C flash drive. So I put one file at a time on a USB flash drive, connect the flash drive to the printer, and then I have a template that I put on the touch screen, and then I select A, B, C, D, and it starts to print. And so that's let's see, A is start. What are the, there's four things I have to pick. Hold on a second. I'm going to grab my template here.
And while you're grabbing that, I assume this would be the sort of thing that either a trusted friend, colleague, if someone uses a service like Be My Eyes or Ira, they might be able to help you sort these menus out for the first couple times.
Yes, yes. I mean, a friend of mine helped me make this. So A is start, B is USB, so I have to select the you know, flash drive, and then C is file name, and then D is print. And it beeps when you press the button, so it's a workable solution, and it's completely reliable. It works every time.
So let's dive in a little bit further. You said the first part of this was acquisition, and getting the models, and it sounds like that's fairly straightforward. Presumably the websites where you might get existing models are, like anything, all over the place when it comes to accessibility, and your skills and familiarity with screen readers and dealing with various environments probably help shape the level of success you have at getting models.
All of that. Yes, exactly right. But you can also make your own models. And there is a text-based CAD program called OpenSCAD, OpenSCAD, which is at OpenSCAD.org. And I am not a programmer, but I am learning to, I've now made, you know, dozens, possibly even hundreds of models using OpenSCAD. And I've gotten a lot of books about OpenSCAD. There's loads of documents. It's an open source program, and it's just amazing. I mean, I'm all the time, I think whatever it is, and you know, I can print something. I can print something for that, you know. And I go and design it. And so, just give you an example. I have some ring. I like to make cookies at Christmas time. And
do you deliver?
I have trouble keeping them from being all eaten. So I have a rings for the ends of my rolling pin, so it makes it easy to roll out an exactly even thickness. And every year, I can never remember the thick. They're different thicknesses. I have a whole set of rings, and so they're all different thicknesses, and they're marked in print on them, but I never can remember what they are. So yesterday, I made a vertical cylinder, and I put braille marks all the way up the cylinder so that I could store my rolling pin rings on this cylinder, and with the sizes marked on it, so I now will remember year after year which size rolling pin ring is which.
So you did all this in this OpenSCAD program?
Yep. I've gotten really into putting braille on labels.
Could you tell us a little bit more about, like, what is that like to, like, the whole process of doing that? I'm fascinated by that. Well, I didn't realize you could actually do that.
You specify everything in shapes. So you say, you know, I want a cube, and I want it to be, you know, and OpenSCAD is very particular about braces and brackets and parentheses and all of this stuff. And you're probably a programmer, so you know about these things. But you have to make sure that all the right things are open and all the right things are closed. But anyway, you have cubes, cylinders, spheres, and then you, if you want to move to some place, you know, you say, I want to make a cube, and it's 50 by 50 by 50. So you now have basically about a, you know, 2-inch cube. But then you want to put something on the top of that cube. You use a translate command, and you tell it, I want to translate to, and you send the, you know, Y axis to 50 and the Z axis to 50. So you want to get on the, you know, top corner of it, or wherever you want to go. You can go to the middle of it, and then if you want to hollow something out, you use the difference command, and then you say, I have a cylinder that's 50 by 50 by 50, but I want it to be a box. So I'm going to take out of it, you know, 48 by 48. And so you use difference to do that. So there's all these commands, and you can really make anything. I mean, you can combine.
Hey, Judy, you talked a lot about the OpenSCAD program and a bunch of, you know, you got to be pretty accurate as far as punctuation and a bunch of other stuff. Presumably things can go wrong. Short of like reading it line by line, character by character, are there tools and such that you can help to figure out what's going wrong?
Yeah, there are. OpenSCAD has a lot of keystrokes that let you do things, and it does, it will tell you, generate errors. And there's fortunately a keystroke that says, take me to my first error. And it will do that. But sometimes you just can't figure out what's wrong. And when that happens, what I've done is cut and paste the whole thing and then plunk it into ChatGPT and say, can you tell me what's wrong with my OpenSCAD script? And it actually knows. And it will come back and say, well, you need a closing bracket on line 28 or something. And it'll tell me what's wrong.
So have you tried asking ChatGPT to, like, say, hey, generate me an OpenSCAD picture of a file of either this picture or this from these words?
Oh, my God, no, I haven't, but that's a great idea. I will try it.
Are you able to take some of these open or these models that you download and load them into this program or import them?
You actually can import them, but you can't read what their commands are. So you can't bring them in, and let's say you wanted a braille label on something. You could bring it in and add a braille label to it, but you can't change the existing thing. You can add things to it, but you can't change what it already is.
So, okay. And when you do make these braille labels, are you able to, do you have to say, I want like a dot of this size, or is there a way to
I have a module that does that. So Yes, but that is exactly how it started. You specify the dot diameter and the dot, the spacing between the dots and so forth. But I had little help from a friend to create these various modules to do Braille.
Before we go further, so you're already a warehouse of information. Do you know of good resources where people are either, like you, for example, are you thinking about writing a book on this? Has somebody else done this?
I proposed a book to National Braille Press, but they are not interested because they say there's not going to be enough interest. But I don't know whether there is or not. But I also created a listserv. It's called 3D Printing Access. It's a Groups.io list.
And spelled like we would assume from everything you just said.
3D hyphen printing hyphen access.
So I might be subscribed, so I'll have to check. But
yeah, it's a real low traffic. Every so often there's a flurry because somebody has a question, and then but people respond, and people are very helpful on that list. But if you wanted to subscribe, it's 3D hyphen printing hyphen access plus subscribe at groups.io.
Would you say overall, I mean, you know, there's a lot of different levels of how well things work. Some work great. Some, if you really work at it, you can get it to work. Where would you overall put this experience? Like, do you find yourself having a lot of success or frustration or both?
Well, yeah, it's one of those things that when I first started, I did have a lot of frustration. I mean, sighted people talk about having trouble with 3D printing, their models not sticking, and it's a big issue. And they have one of the biggest conversations on the general 3D printing list is about, you know, how to keep your models from sliding around on the build plate. And it's not a problem that I've had. So, I mean, that's great. But they talk about, you know, using hairspray to spray your build plate to keep models from sliding around. And I've never even had to do that. But they also talk about printing spaghetti. And one of the things you learn as a blind person is how the sounds that it makes, because it makes a lot of different sounds. And you quickly learn when you hear a particular sound, oh, the printer is not happy. It is not printing correctly. And I would say, you know, when I first started, probably one out of every five, maybe, prints would not be successful. And now it's probably not even one out of 100 prints are not successful. So I can't absolutely tell you what's changed because it's, who knows? but yeah, I mean, mostly it works. What the other issue is, I'll print something, I'll make it an open scan. And one of the problems for us, and I've tried various solutions to this, because in OpenSCAD, there's all kinds of views. And I've tried using AI. I've tried, you know, just printing. I'm an Opticon user from way back. So I've tried, you know, printing and looking at it with the Opticon. I've tried printing it on swell paper. I've tried all kinds of ways to tell what the model looks like without having to print it to find out. And none of those ways has been even vaguely successful. It's that three-dimensional object on a two-dimensional piece of paper problem.
Yep. Just so folks know who may not be familiar with the term Opticon, which I'm a user of that device myself, learned it when I was 7 years old. It stands for, and Judy, you can correct anything I say, optical to tactile converter. And it was a device that was came out in the probably early 70s. To the best of my knowledge, hasn't been manufactured in probably more than close to
85. It stopped at 85, yes.
And basically, you take a camera, and you run that camera over print. The camera's a little bit longer than
Here's the sound.
Thank you. Oh, the good old click. And what that the camera's probably a couple inches long and maybe an inch wide. It's pretty small. Right. It's got two little rollers and then some lights and a little slider on the top that adjusts the magnification. That camera takes the pictures and sends it down a wire to this box-like device where you insert your hand and you put, typically, at least for me, it was my left hand.
I think it pretty much is for everybody.
I think it
unless
has
they,
to, well,
yeah.
I think it'd be pretty hard to do it the other. Actually, it'd be almost.
Well,
possible.
the way they've designed it, yes. I did hear that you could special order a right-handed Opticon, but you had to be a person who like only had a right hand or something to get it.
And then on your finger is this array. It's called the vibrotactile array, and that noise that you heard was actually the pins vibrating. If I remember correctly, I used to know all this because
144.
That's what I thought. It's 144 pins. Yeah. And it's actually unfortunate that in my opinion, that the device didn't catch on as widely as it could. I wouldn't have been able to get through college, for example, I know for me, without an Opticon.
Well, I can tell you, I think of all the technology in my life, braille displays, computers, you name it, the Opticon. I mean, if my house was burning down, I would grab my Opticon. I mean, it's the most useful thing that I have. And I just don't know how. I mean, I feel very sad that it didn't succeed and that there hasn't been. There were three efforts that I'm aware of that where the National Science Foundation funded a new Opticon, and all three efforts ended in camera-based scanning solutions that were not at all an Opticon. I mean, I think that the developers didn't get what exactly the Opticon does, and it's you know, the human is the intelligence with the Opticon, because you know we're looking at a tactile image of the print on the page, but I can understand fonts, I can understand characters that there might not be a braille equivalent of, or you know, even or diagrams and patterns, and you know, you can look at your tie patterns and things like that. And so my husband and I are both Opticon users, and we have several Opticons around the house, and it's a device that I use every single day.
In full transparency, I have not used mine as much. I do not, because I have two Opticons here, and for various reasons they only run for about 5 minutes and then I've got to turn them off.
You can get them fixed.
And I probably, I'm going to have to look into that further, because when I was actually just thinking about this the other day, and I like all the new technology and the AI and all of that is amazing. And we could talk about that maybe if we have time, but, I think if you learned an Opticon, I know that just in my head, it is still the foundation of, a lot of what I understand about the visual world came from using an Opticon. And it really is unfortunate.
I print a check, and I go to and I print it upstairs on my printer. I carry it downstairs. I don't know why I don't have a pen upstairs, but I have a pen downstairs. So I carry the check downstairs and I go to sign it. And I've been walking around the house and things happen. Is this check upside down? Is it right side up? I don't know. And so you know, I just grab the Opticon and look at it to see whether it's right side up or upside down so I can sign it in the right place. And I would a scanner do that? Probably not. The scanners are too smart. They'll read it whether it's upside down or right side up. So, I mean, I don't, there's so many things, so many little things I do in a day that I don't know how I would even do it without an OptiPop.
And that could be a whole nother discussion sometime. I was just thinking about this because I actually, back in the day, I mean, I learned to read some people's handwriting.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did that too.
So that was pretty amazing. So back to the 3D printing.
We can't tell with OpenSCAD. The only way to tell how your model is going to look is to print. And there have been plenty of times when I've printed my model and, no, that's not quite right. I want it to be a little different. So I go and fix it and print it again. And it doesn't take forever. I mean, the Provo Marriott took 22 hours to print. But that's the biggest thing I've ever printed. Most things that I print take, you know, between maybe an hour, half hour, 2 hours, something, you know. Like that.
So how did you get the model for the Marriott, or did you make that?
I didn't make it. No, it's quite complex. There's an organization in Ohio called C3D, SEE3D.org, and it's really wonderful. This young woman started it, and it's been running now for 4 or 5 years. And actually, C3D.org is a great resource because they do have a resource page of a lot of places where you can get models and get more information about 3D printing. But they also will make, they have a lot of models that they'll send to blind people for free, just for informational purposes, things like the Statue of Liberty and the White House, just so people might want to know what they look like. But they'll also make models on request. And I asked them to do it because it was definitely beyond my skills. And because they can make them from photographs.
And do they have, I was actually going to ask about that very sort of thing. Like, is it a nonprofit? Do they take donations?
It is a nonprofit. They don't charge. They take donations. And it is a nonprofit.
So let's say hypothetically, I'm a big, and you would know more about this, perhaps. How are 3D models versus another solution for things like maps?
Well, okay. Well, let's take TouchMapper, for example. So you can get the San Francisco Lighthouse to, send you a map of an intersection, and they charge for it. You can, you know, if you have your own swell paper and you know, machine to do that, you can download from TouchMapper those same maps and output them with Braille or print labels. But what you get are streets, you know, lines, and then you get labels. But if you take, TouchMapper also has a facility to create an STL file, a 3D printable file. And when you do that, you don't get any labels, but you get streets that are lines, and you get buildings. And the buildings are even the right shape. Now, they're not a whole building. They're only like a half an inch tall. But they're, I mean, we did our street, all the different houses on the street, you can tell which ones are big houses and which ones are smaller houses. Our street actually has a minor curve in it, and you can even see that on this map. And it's very, very, it's, you know, you do get a richer experience with the 3D printed map versus just a line drawing.
So you talked about fill and other things, and maybe someone's done this, but I don't think so ever. For years, I've never done anything about it other than think about it. And I wonder, I asked you before we started recording if you were into sports, and you said no, which is fine. I do enjoy sports from time to time. But one of the things, I've always had this idea of making a book, and when a person hits a home run in baseball, they say, hey, he touched them all, right? Because the person ran to all the bases. I thought it'd be cool to make a book of kind of, if you will, the top-down view of sports stadiums, where you can feel both kind of the playing field, especially in baseball, where fields and the fields themselves are different shapes a little bit. And they all have around the edge what they call a warning track, different spaces. Do you think this is the sort of thing that a 3D model would be good at?
Yes, definitely. As a matter of fact, I know there are. Another interest of mine is tactile models of buildings and monuments and so forth. And I actually got interested in an organization called the Souvenir Building Collectors Society. And these are people who worry about like what it's made of and who made it. And I didn't care about that at all. I only cared about, you know, could I understand it and, you know, what did it look like? But I've been to several of their conventions over the years, and they also have stadiums, all of them, and they in tactile models. So I'm sure you could find 3D printable stadiums of all of them. And older, and ones that don't exist anymore, and all that kind of thing.
That's fascinating as well. You know, I was fortunate when I went to school. I was the teacher when I went to school, and I started in kindergarten. I went half a day and did, quote, you know, regular old kindergarten, and then that was in the morning. In the afternoon, they were just starting to, quote, mainstream people in Wisconsin. I don't even know if it was called mainstreaming then. and I was actually the first student of someone who had just finished college. I've lost touch with her. I wish, you know, sometimes in life you have people that had a big influence, but you were so young you don't really appreciate it. I know my mom used to keep in touch with this lady more. Her name was, first it was Miss Augsburger, and then it became Mrs. Sankin. But she taught me something that, this is why I'm also intrigued by 3D models, because I don't know where she got the resources to do it, but we had these huge, like, boxes and boxes full of toys. And when we read stories, you know, they mentioned an alligator. She'd go get an alligator from the toy box, or a garbage truck, or a fire truck, or a space, or a rocket. And that's still something that I do today, you know, try and find models of things because I want to know what they're like. And I think, like, buildings and all of that are always fascinating. So you've given me a couple things, new things to think about here already.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a website called Yegi, Yeggi. It's a search, like a search engine for STL files. And I'm just looking for stadiums. And there's Busch Stadium.
Well, if anybody from the National Brow Press ever comes across this podcast episode, please rethink your decision. I mean, I know you all do great work, and you have to figure out your resources, but I think this is an area of untapped potential for people to be able to feel the world. AI descriptions and such are wonderful. I mean, I'm still intrigued and fascinated by those, but there's nothing quite like being able to feel something in my mind.
Well, I kind of agree with you.
Let me ask this. So, of the successes you've had, and what would you say is the most interesting thing you yourself have either, you know, printed?
Oh, interesting. That's so hard. I'm a very practical person. I print things to make my life easier. I print things to provide me with information. A lot of people are interested in printing, you know, art objects and statues and my husband likes to print model cars. I have no interest in that. So I have a a Sonos Move speaker, and it's a touch speaker. So I created a 3D printed rim to fit on top of it, to go around it so that I could mark where the volume up, volume down, play, pause, and all those things were, so I can just touch the rim, run my finger around it, and then find the right place on the touch screen without having to look around on the touch screen and make things happen that I didn't want to happen. So, I mean, that's a cool thing, and it's very useful, and it works great. But that's the kind of thing that I print. I've designed a lot of measuring devices, measuring cups with Braille on the inside, where God intended Braille to be. And it's really handy. And so I'm making tools and devices and things like that.
You might not know the answer to this, but this filament and such. And when you print 3D models, when I was researching a little bit about some of this, I'll see that they talk about people painting their models and stuff afterward.
Yes.
Do you know what color models come out?
Because here's one issue with buying a 3D printer. Most 3D printers only have one extruder. And so you buy your filament in colors. It comes in, you know, all primary colors, black, white, gray, pink, blue, purple, things like that. But your spool is all one color. And then when you print it, your thing is all one color. So that's why people paint them, because, you know, it'll come out whatever color of filament you had. And there's different kinds of filament. I haven't experimented a lot with this. There's filament that has, like, you know, wood shavings in it and feels like wood, they say, or metal in it. I think that your success rate goes down significantly when you start playing around with different kinds of filament. There's a lot of warnings that go with them, and it's a lot of complication. There's, you know, filament with glitter in it. But the other thing is that you can't print anything that where a part of the object is over air. So, or very much of it at all is over air. So it's, you have to have what is called supports. And 3D, Simplify 3D is very good at this. It'll say your model needs supports. And then it has a function where it will auto-generate the supports. So it's going to print, you know, imagine like little legs or little things to hold it up.
So a bridge over the Grand Canyon, for example, wouldn't work so well.
Right, unless you had supports. So then you have to break them away, and then you have to then sand your model so that, you know, when you break it away, it leaves little bits and pieces, you know, splinters and rough parts and so forth. So then you have to sand it to smooth it out. Well, another way of dealing with this problem is they have filament that's soluble. So you print, you say, I want you to print my model from spool A and take my support from spool B. So if you had a printer that had two extruders, you can run two different filaments. So these the supports are soluble. So all you do is throw them in a pan of warm water when you get done, and the support dissolves and goes away. And I don't have a printer that can do that. And that's my next printer. Not only is it going to be bigger, it's going to have two extruders so that I can use soluble supports, and I don't have to break them off and sand them. And that will significantly expand the kinds of things I can print.
So you talked about that, and this happens to anybody, you can print string, if you will, like just when things don't go right.
Oh, yes.
Any big, hopefully you find them somewhat humorous now, but catastrophes when you got started, or maybe that happened even yesterday, that you want to share?
No, that was, I mean, the worst is that when you think you've printed something and then you go and find a, you know, big pile of spaghetti on your printer, and you see you don't have anything. The other thing I have learned is, and that's another thing about buying a printer, there's some printers that come with enclosures, so it's closed up, and it's, some people in the 3D printing world think it's a kind of marketing gimmick to make people think that it's a better printer because it's enclosed and the heat will be even. And my printer is not enclosed, so I can actually, I've learned how to touch it while it's printing. And that was, at first, as I was learning how to touch it, I didn't quite know how to do it. So as the printing head would move, it would hit my hand hard enough that my hand hit the print and I would dislodge it in mid print. And this did not work. But now I've learned exactly how to touch it, so I can tell what it's doing when it's printing.
And when this is done, like, because of how this all works, do you have to let the model sit for a little while, or?
No. Actually, there's sometimes, if I touch it really quick, I can knock off a braille dot. But I mean, we're talking about seconds that you, because you can take it off the build, on the printer is a build plate, and this is a magnetic aluminum, a magnetic sheet, not aluminum because it's magnetic. And so you, when the print finishes, you can pick up the sheet, and the sheet is slightly flexible and it has a texture to it. This is what keeps your model from sliding around. And as soon as you bend that even slightly, the model pops off and you've got it. I mean, you don't have to let it cool or anything.
If you had to describe the feeling of your models, just like, are they, like, do they feel smooth like plastic? Are they rough?
They feel smooth like plastic. When all is going well, they do. You can feel the little green in it by the layers. You can feel that. And then you can set how many, you can make really, the default is 0.2 millimeters for layer height. But I like to print with 0.1. just because I like a finer grain and a finer textured print. It makes it take longer, but that's the only downside.
So back in the day, I used to sit with a VersaPoint Braille printer in my workplace office and had to print a lot of documents for one of my jobs. And anybody who's ever been around a Braille printer knows those things can be really loud. How loud or quiet,
it's probably depends on the printer.
But.
It's not. I'm sure it does depend on the printer, and I've only had one. But it's not as loud as an embosser. It makes different noise. It makes all kinds of noises. I mean, the embosser is kind of one noise, and I mean, but we can tell what the embosser is doing too when it's, you know, spitting out a half a blank page, or when it's, brailing short things, or when it's only brailing on one side of the page. I mean, you learn the sound of your embosser, you know what it's doing. It's the same thing with the 3D printer. You can tell when it's printing a solid layer versus when it's printing an infill. You can tell. Then my printer also has an app. And the app is actually better than its software, because I can actually look at the app and see how many layers has it printed and how many does it have to go. And so I can tell what it's doing then. But the printer has fans, and the fans will, it's kind of like a computer. The fans will run and run faster and slower depending on the need.
So you got a lot of stuff going on here. You're, you know, extruding this filament and all this. What kind of maintenance are is there? Is this messy?
It's not messy. Sometimes when you print spaghetti, the little bits and pieces of filament will be around. But in general, it's not messy. Because the filament all stays together, and the filament's on a roll that's above the printer, and the printer just pulls it down. But I've replaced the nozzles a couple of times, And I have had to replace the entire, they call it the hot end, the whole part of it that heats up and so forth. And it was really fun because I did it with a friend. Oh, let me tell them about, a lot of printers can connect by Wi-Fi. My printer has a camera. And these cameras are designed for like sighted people who are sitting in their kitchen and want to see how their printer's doing. And they can just look at it on their phone and see it print, you know, see it, what it's doing and know when it's finished. I have a friend in Germany who looks at my printer. It's like, you know, could you look at this thing and see it's doing something weird. And I don't know what it's doing. Is it okay? And so he can actually look at it. And so it's very cool to be able to do that. So the Wi-Fi also lets me look at it with the app, which is really handy.
What would you say, if anything? It sounds like you've found a lot of the end-to-end experience. You've made it work. Is there something that you're like, if the industry could do this one or this thing, it would make my life that much easier? Kind of like, if we ignore, like, hey, you got to learn this all, how it works and all that, the startup learning, if you will, are there things that you'd like to see the industry like kind of address that would, eliminate some of the frustrations or challenges that you experience now that you're a veteran with the technology?
Well, it sure would be nice if the manufacturer's software wasn't so inaccessible. It would be nice if the touchscreen talked. I can look at the touchscreen with you know, like seeing AI or something and find out what all it says. And, you know, if point and, what is it, point and, what's an Apple feature?
Oh, they're...
point and shoot or yeah, point and something. Point and something. If it worked better, it could be kind of a cool thing to use to access the touchscreen. I think most 3D printers have touchscreens, and I don't know a lot about other printers that I don't have. A friend suggested that I get this one, and having a 3D printing buddy is a great idea. So there's a lot of, you know, make spaces and so forth in towns. A lot of libraries have them, and you know, it's probably not too hard to find sighted people to help.
You've mentioned your printer several times. Would you be comfortable sharing the model that you have?
Oh, sure. It's an Anchor Make M5. It's actually on sale right now. through Christmas, it's on sale for like $350. When I bought it, it was about $550.
Really?
So it's not a terribly expensive printer, and I've been so happy with it. It's just great. And then filament, you can buy filament on Amazon for like $15 a roll. And a roll is a kilo of filament, and you can print a lot. I mean, the Provo Marriott took like more than half a roll, but most things, I mean, I can probably, you know, when I'm printing smaller things, I can print, you know, probably 50 things with a roll of filament.
So are you printing anything right now?
No.
What's the next thing you're going to print?
I don't know. I finished my rolling pin ring project. I made a whole bunch of, I have to like do things with printed forms. Dealing with printed forms is one of those areas that I have never found good technology to deal with it. So I mostly use the Opticon. So I made a whole bunch of little things to like check boxes, one for doing my initials, one for doing the date, one for doing. So I have all these little tiny flat templates for filling in forms. I finished that project. I haven't decided. I'm sure I'll think of something. I'm just turning the printer on just to It's going to beep when it comes on and that's it's
There.
beeping when it that means it's ready, and then I could do the little it's I don't think you can even hear it. It's the fan is running, but it doesn't really make too much noise when it's not printing.
So one of my questions, whether I always like to say is, you know, I've asked you kind of a lot of questions here, but I'm by no means an expert. So are there things I haven't asked you about that you're like, wow, if I'm going to talk about this, people should know this? Like, consider this open season to whatever else you think people should know.
I think I've mostly thrown those in as we've gone along. I think it's a very cool and very viable hobby for blind people, and you know, will you need a little help from time to time? Yeah, probably. But will you need a lot of help? No, not necessarily. So it's, you know, it's something that you can do reasonably independently.
Well, that's great. Hey, Judy, I really appreciate your time and thoughtfulness and detailed explanation. One of the fun things, I guess, about, you know, trying to do a podcast from time to time here is I get to ask the questions about things that interest me if I can find somebody. And this for me personally, and hopefully for others, has been an area that I've been curious about. I know some people have been on the cutting edge, such as yourself. I just haven't really delved further. I've got a lot of other things that I poke around at, both professionally and personally. But I suspect in 2025, for me, a 3D printer may be in the offing and dabbling more. So I appreciate your level of knowledge and your sharing of your time.
Sure. No problem. Happy to do it.
I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode of the podcast To Be Named Later.